I'll rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case is 2020-341, Janine Lycan et al. Versus the City of Cleveland et al. For the appellant, Mr. Singletary.
Good morning. Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the panel. My name is Gary Singletary. I'm chief counsel for the city. With me today is Assistant Director of Law Craig Maurice. We're here representing the city in this appeal. This appeal stems from a decision of the 8th District Court of Appeals dealing with the city's former camera ordinance. Back in late 2005, the city had enacted.
You've made, in briefs, you made a whole lot of arguments about final judgments, res judicata. What is your best argument that this was a final judgment?
The best argument, Your Honor? The best argument, and if it pleases the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The best argument is that found in the case of Carroll versus the City of Cleveland, which was a case that was predicated on the same kinds of issues that are presented in this case, including a claim for unjust enrichment. Now, the Carroll case was referred to by the 8th District earlier as a copycat case for that reason. It was removed to the federal court, unlike this case, because they had also included other causes of action, including a 1983 due process claims. The Carroll court, in analyzing this matter, looked at the Dixon and Campbell case with regards to the availability of the administrative appeal and the success that someone similar to the class of non-owners in this case could proceed with an administrative appeal. The court found that the plaintiffs, the class in this case, when they admitted liability by paying the civil citation without engaging in the administrative appeal that was available to them, that the court found that to be the same as a final order, if it would have been a trial court, the same as a final judgment. In that regard, because the plaintiffs had the opportunity and they waived that opportunity, but they did participate in the administrative appeal process by way of they paid the $100 fine for the most part.
Counsel, had they initiated a protest to the issuance of the ticket under the law the way it was at the time, what would the outcome have been of the administrative process?
It would have been the outcome that was found in Dixon and Campbell versus the City of Cleveland. Dixon and Campbell is exactly on point with
What would that outcome have been?
The administrative hearing officer would have probably rejected the defense being a non-owner. But the
because
fact
because there was no exception carved out in the city at that time, the city code, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Because there was no exception carved out as there was subsequently, right?
Yes and no, Your Honor. There was.
Wouldn't that then make it futile?
No, Your Honor, because futility goes to the entire administrative remedy process, not just the discretion of the administrative hearing officer
himself. But if they went through the administrative hearing and they were going to lose, and then how would they ever get to court? Because your other argument is, if they go through the administrative process, it's res judicata.
Well, Your Honor, they would have gotten to the court with the administrative appeal by filing a 2506 appeal after the hearing officer He had discretion, Your Honor. It wasn't written in our code that they had to automatically go against them.
And how many times did any administrative judge go with them?
There is no record in that regard, Your Honor. I will say, though, that if you look at the Eighth District's opinion, the court makes clear that at least one of the plaintiffs in this case, Mr. Murphy, had received 5 tickets. Apparently, the hearing officer released him from 4, and he only had to pay $100. So there is a certain level of discretion, even under the old, before the law was amended, that whether you win or lose at the administrative hearing stage is not determinative of whether you have an adequate remedy at law. This court, back with the Scott case back in 2006, decided that 413.031 did provide an adequate remedy at law because one had the right to a 2506 appeal.
But I'm going to stop you there. The 2506 appeal is to the Common Pleas Court, and it requires a record. And for a $100 traffic ticket, how easy is that for an ordinary citizen, and how meaningful of an appeal is that under 2506?
Well, Your Honor, I believe it's very meaningful. In fact, we cite to the case Reginald Barnes, the City of Cleveland versus Mr. Barnes. Mr. Barnes was a pro se ticket receiver who brought an administrative hearing appeal. The administrative hearing officer did not accept his defense. He then filed the 2506 appeal with the court, and actually Mr. Barnes ended up prevailing. The initial appeal in this matter is free. And what the Dixon and Campbell case, which is the case where lessee actually appealed and won the case on and 2506 appeal shows, is that the court does what 2506 allows it to do and what this court has found to be an adequate remedy at law. In fact, the Eighth District Court of Appeals itself back in the Scott days made the pronouncement that where one has a 2506 right of appeal, it goes without saying, I believe is the phrase they use, that one has an adequate remedy at law. Now, the $100 fine that was paid, the initial administrative hearing would be free. The filing fee to go to the court after that was $100. If you look at the Dixon and Campbell case, the decision in that matter, he recovered his cost in that particular case. So res judicata, the fact that the administrative hearing officer and what Ms. Vargas indicated with regards to the chances of winning, saying that you were a non-owner, is irrespective of the adequate remedy at law in this case, because the administrative hearing officer is only the first stage. And what it goes to with regards to a vain act or a futile act is whether the hearing officer or the administrative agency has the authority or the power. And if you look at our ordinance, the administrative hearing officer and the sequencing of events had the power and authority to hear the defense that was raised. Dixon and Campbell raised it.
Counsel, the defense is I wasn't driving the car, or excuse me, I'm not the owner of the car. And the statute refers to the owner of the car.
That's right, Your Honor. And the Eighth District, in considering that particular issue in Dixon and Campbell, found that the city was mistaken with regards to its reliance on the Bureau of Motor Vehicles identifying the lessees as additional owners. So they were identified as owners, but they weren't the leasing company that actually owned the car. The city believed that, based on its language of its ordinance, that it had the authority to issue tickets to lessees as additional owners under its rules. Now, the 8th District disagreed with us on that. We disagreed with the 8th District. We tried to appeal to this court, and it was not accepted. So the city, within 20 days of the Dixon and Campbell decision, amended its ordinance to include lessees and renters, non-owners.
Help me understand. What I don't understand at all is the case came to this court. It was sent back to the trial court, and you filed a motion for summary judgment where you said you weren't relitigating res judicata, which seems to be really what your argument is here. Why would you possibly, why would you do that?
Well, I didn't do that, Your Honor.
Why would the city do that? I mean,
Your Honor, we had, as this court recognized when it heard the class certifying appeal, this court recognized that the court, in ruling on summary judgment, when it denied our summary judgment based on res judicata, that the class cert appeal that we filed did not allow us to then appeal concurrently with the class cert the denial of summary judgment on the issue. Going back after that case, there were two cases that have been decided that were not available to the lower courts at the time that our class cert appeal was up. One of those was Jodka, and the other was Walker versus Toledo. Now, when we went back to the court, what we told the court was there were two cases, Walker and Jodka, that we wanted the court to consider. We tried to make clear with our motion, so the court wasn't confused on the matter, that we understand that summary judgment's already been ruled upon on the issue of res judicata. That's preserved for when the final judgment comes in, we would then have an appeal on that. What we did interimly was put Walker and Jodka before the court and told the court that we weren't relitigating the issue with this motion. It's not that we gave up the issue. I mean, that wouldn't make any sense at all, given the fact this court had recognized that we had, that it wasn't ripe to be considered at that time. We think res judicata is a great defense, and it's one that fits the bill on this one, just as the Sixth Circuit decided. Now, the issue on failure to exhaust administrative remedies, we think that one's self-evident. Also, I see my time with the 5 minutes.
Well, I want to ask you a question about the Eighth District opinion. I believe the city's own employee, the deposition testimony of Administrator Vargas, the city's then administrator of the Parking Violations Bureau and Photo Safety Division, revealed that any administrative remedy the class would have availed themselves to would have been futile. That's the city admitting it would have been futile.
No, Your Honor. What Maria Vargas testified to as the clerk of the court was that according to our business rules, lessees were considered as additional owners. And so therefore, as an additional owner, we thought they were liable and could receive a citation directly from us. The ordinance itself would have allowed tickets to eventually get to the lessee if the leasing company identified them as the owner of the vehicle. By using the additional owner and sending the ticket directly to them, we cut out some of the time, but that wasn't the reason that it was done. The reason it was done is because we thought, as an additional owner, our law authorized them to receive the tickets directly. The court found that was incorrect, but the futility goes to whether they had the power and authority. I would suggest that Mr. Murphy's case shows that there is authority, discretion in the hearing officer himself. But notwithstanding that, the futility is not based on a single administrative hearing officer. It's based on the entire administrative remedy package, and that includes 2506. That's the basis for finding an adequate
remedy
at law. I understand
that, but specifically, she says, Administrator Vargas testified that any motorist raising the argument during an administrative hearing, that's any motorist, that they were not the owners of the vehicle cited and thus not subject to the ordinance, would lose such an appeal.
Well, they would lose it the administrative hearing officer appeal, according to her testimony.
Right. If they didn't pay the fine, you know, the $100, which everybody does because of the, you know, $100 is in some ways very significant to some people, but obviously other people, it's not. It wouldn't warrant taking off work. It wouldn't warrant all the other things that are necessary. So they paid the fine. But instead of paying the fine, if they would have gone to the administrative hearing, they would not have been successful.
At the administrative hearing, Your Honor, the adequate remedy at law includes the 2506 appeal, because the 2506 appeal gives the court the opportunity to review the hearing officer's ruling. They can correct unconstitutional rulings, they can correct illegal rulings, they can look at the discretion that was employed. So however the administrative hearing officer would have ruled had no finality to it with regards to the adequate remedy at law. In fact, Dixon and Campbell shows the adequate remedy at law that was there with regards to the city being instructed that how it was hearing these cases was incorrect.
I mean, that's not really, I'm over here, I'm
sorry.
It's confusing sometimes. I mean, you're really making, though, you're making a res judicata argument. You're not saying that they could have exhausted their administrative remedies. They wouldn't have had any relief in the administrative process, but they could have taken it to a court, which would make it res judicata. Isn't that really what you're arguing?
Well, Your Honor,
you're kind of trying to put it in failure to exhaust administrative remedies, but you're really just making a res judicata argument.
Well, we're making both arguments, Your Honor. I think failure to exhaust administrative remedies is self-evident by the fact that...
Is a court proceeding an administrative remedy? I mean, it's...
Well, since Grava, this court has recognized that administrative hearings do have both res judicata effect and also that it's an administrative remedy that one has... We've cited numerous cases with regards to that if one does not take the appeal that's offered, the administrative appeal, then one's waived their right to then contest the same issues.
But that's a res judicata, right? If you have...
Well, I think Walker versus Toledo looked at the deal with respect to a plaintiff in that particular case who had paid a fine and then tried to challenge the ordinance under similar circumstances. They were claiming that it was a constitutional issue with regards to whether muni courts heard these cases or not. But with respect to what the court ruled in that case was that you must exhaust your administrative remedies if they're available, or you can't seek judicial remedy. One of the cases they cite is the A.M. Parrott case from the 8th District Court of Appeals.
So what would the record be in the 2505-06 appeal? Assuming somebody started and did their administrative appeal and then lost, which is probably to be expected, and went on to do the 2505-06 appeal before the Common Pleas Court, which handles felonies and death penalty cases and major civil litigation, what would the record be that the trial judge or the magistrate would have to look at?
Well, there's a transcript that's made of the hearing that's presented. The evidence is presented.
Is that the video?
The video is present, yes. And as the codified ordinance makes clear, the video itself is prima facie evidence of the violation. So the hearing officer would have been looking at the video. That video would have been available to the Common Pleas Court, along with the transcript of what the hearing officer said, what the defense that was put before them. And the Dixon Campbell case is clearly on point with regards to this matter on the issue of failure to exhaust your administrative remedies and also res judicata. The Carroll case, going back to the A.M. Parrott case, that particular case they put before this court saying it was a vain or futile act because in the Parrott case, a house had been demolished by the city. Plaintiff sues, in effect, for a takings claim for the loss of his property. The city then alleged that he did not exhaust his administrative remedies. The judge in the case, in reviewing the matter, indicated that the administrative remedy that was available had nothing, there was no power, no authority for the court to consider the issue that was before it, which is compensation for a building that had been demolished. And so Parrick is distinguished from this case because as 2506, the hearing officer had authority to consider their defense. They then had the right to appeal. So there was no issue of no authority or power.
They come before the hearing officer. They show the lease agreement. They say, I wasn't and never was. I am not now and never was the owner of the vehicle. And the hearing officer says, I sympathize, but I must find against you. And then they go to the appeal. All right. Now, the video is prima facie evidence of the violation. Am I right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. On appeal, they take a look at it. The same defense. I'm not the owner. Here's my lease agreement. Here's what the statute says. They're not going to be successful on their appeal.
Who's not going to be successful?
The individual, the lessee for the vehicle.
You mean when they're before the trial court or the court of appeals?
No. For their appeal. What can the trial court do in the face of that evidence?
Well, I believe the trial court could say that your ordinance talks in terms of owners. These people are not owners, so therefore, as was the case in Dixon and Campbell, the court ruled against the city on a 2506 appeal. I should note that was a 2-1 decision because the dissenting court judge recognized that the law that the BMV identified lessees as additional owners, and she believed the city would have had the authority to interpret its ordinance in that regard. But that's the value of a 2506. The city learned from the 8th District's decision and amended its ordinance almost immediately. These folks are before you today. They took no actions on their own behalf at the time they could have contested this issue. And that distinguishes this case from every case they cite, whether it's someone filing a deck action that's refused because they didn't do administrative appeal or any other matter. These folks waited until after an administrative appeal and Dixon and Campbell was decided, and then they decided they would all file a class action lawsuit based on an administrative appeal. It was not a declaratory judgment action. It was an administrative appeal that did nothing more than say, city, you were wrong with that particular decision.
But the statute permits you to, it's a new action in the Common Pleas Court, and you can combine a declaratory judgment action with a 2505-06 appeal. I don't see where you're going with this argument.
Well, Your Honor, you would not be allowed to do a separate declaratory judgment action at the same time you have the appeal.
No, they can be combined. It's a separate action. The court has the ability to bring in new evidence in a 2505-06 appeal. The court's hands aren't tied.
Well, Your Honor, it's clear that the law does allow for the court on appeal to decide the issue of whether the order was unconstitutionally applied. But a hearing officer himself does not have authority to make constitutional rulings.
But the 2505-06 appeal is a separate filing, and it's not just as applied that the court can deal with the issue. The court can be combined with declaratory judgment, and the court can hear the matter on its face. Do you disagree?
Well, I believe that would be an unusual circumstance in the sense that if you're in the administrative appeal process, you then file a 2506 appeal, there is no separate declaratory judgment action pending at that time.
I understand, but because there's no ability to really challenge the constitutionality in the appeal process until you get to Common Pleas Court, the Common Pleas Court is a court of general jurisdiction. It can decide those matters, and it doesn't need to decide them in two separate matters. If you look at the history of what's gone on in the Common Pleas Court, especially Franklin County, it happens quite frequently.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that if you're claiming that an ordinance is unconstitutional on its face, you have the absolute right to file a declaratory judgment action, notwithstanding any appellate administrative appeal regulations. With regards to as applied, it's a little less clear, but it's clear that the reviewing court has the authority to consider whether the application of the ordinance was unconstitutional. I don't know if we're crossing terms here with regard
to effect. I think we agree on that.
It is a declaratory judgment in that sense, but it's not a formal declaratory judgment that's been separately filed with the court. It arises within the administrative appeal itself, and that's the value of the 2506 appeal. It gives the court the authority to review, similar to a declaratory judgment action, on the application issue. I see I've well exceeded my time here.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Mr. Flowers, if you'll wait till the microphone is sanitized.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Paul Flowers. I represent the plaintiff appellees here, Janine Lakin et al., joined by my co-counsel, Craig Bashine, who made the trip down this morning. We're both really pleased to be here. It's terrific being back live in front of the court with an interesting appeal that we're here for on the second time. I thought I would start off with Chief Justice O'Connor's questioning with regards to what would the outcome be if any of these administrative appeals had been followed. And I think it's now been established, even conceded, that at the administrative level it would have been lost. And that was based squarely upon the testimony of Maria Vargas, who was not only the director of the Parking Violations Bureau, who's running this program, but she's also the designated Rule 30B5 representative for the city in these proceedings. And on pages 169 to 170 of her deposition, the question is asked, so before Blake Dixon, anybody that requested a hearing, if it was on the issue of having a leased vehicle, that administrative process would be moot because they weren't going to win it, correct? There's an objection, an answer, that would be correct. And this was not just based upon, you know, some sort of a informal policy or not that was going on there. That a business rule had actually been adopted in writing, which the 8th District highlights in their decision. And the business rule flatly stated, you know, that they were going to cite everyone. And remember, lessees are just an example. That the ordinance was written so that only an owner could be cited. So anybody renting, borrowing, whatever, was not included. And that was intentional. That was the way the original ordinance was enacted, as kind of a compromise measure.
Counselor, help me understand. I'm just trying to understand how this rule that at least comes out of this case would work in practice. So Cleveland, I assume, has a building code department. I assume that there's people who have building code violations. I assume there's people that have paid those violations. Is there anything in your mind that would present someone from now filing a class action saying that Cleveland was incorrectly interpreting its building codes?
No, I think you have to go on a case-by-case basis for each one of these. When you're talking about a building code or maybe a zoning issue or so forth, those are pretty sophisticated.
So traffic camera cases are different. You can pay the fine, and you can you can go back and relitigate those, but you can't other administrative actions?
Right. Litigate them for the first time.
How do you get that rule? I mean, that seems, I mean, I know we don't like, some people don't like red light cameras, but how do you get the rule? How do you get the rule that different procedures apply than anywhere else in the administrative system?
Well, you've got several features about this case in particular. Perhaps the one that stands out the most is Maria Vargas just flat out saying they're not going to win, and it's because this business rule in writing. You're not going to have that in those examples.
Well, you could have a situation where the city building department is interpreting the code one way, and you decide years later they interpret it wrongly. So let's relitigate those cases. Let's file a class action. Why couldn't you do that?
Well, you would have, in that sort of situation, you are going to have prior decisions. I mean, it's assumed that they all went through it. This isn't the sort of thing where a landlord gets cited and they just send in the money. That's what happens here. Remember, these are civil penalties. So we've got that. And remember, at the second level,
there's two. Building codes, the same thing. Sometimes people just pay them. Sometimes they go contest them. But they're still civil penalties, just like this.
Right. I really don't think you're going to have that situation where they just say flat out administrative, you're not going to win, because administratively they do win. It's a different animal, and that's what I'm saying. You got to go case by case on these.
Well, but there could be a situation where there was an interpretation of the code that said this is not in a historic district or something, and maybe some attorney decides that the building code had been the appeals process had been interpreting that wrongly. So you can go file a class action and relitigate those?
Well, right. But then when you get to the 2506 appeal, I mean, just setting aside the Vargas testimony, when you get to the 2506 appeal, for a lot of those cases, that does make sense. You've got lawyers involved. There's a lot at stake. They can go through that. They have the sophistication. They have the finances and all that.
So the rule is just that people who get traffic camera tickets aren't as sophisticated, so they get different rules?
It's the proceeding that's not as sophisticated, certainly not the people. And it took a lawyer getting cited who was willing to go through 2 years of 2506 litigation, and it was very vigorously contested by the city's attorneys. You can't do one of these without a lawyer, which by itself is going to cost thousands of dollars. And that's money that you don't get back. You win, yeah, maybe you don't have to pay your ticket, but you still pay your lawyer. And you're going to pay those court costs up front. It's $100 for common pleas, another $100 for court of appeals probably. That is not free. Maybe their administrative proceeding is free, but the court system is not. And then you get into the whole issue about, you know, for these types of cases, you know, how practical is this? And it isn't. It's not an effective remedy.
So is there a line then? How many, what the fine is then that we should use to decide when you can relitigate something that's already been decided?
Well, that's a big consideration. And remember, I mean, the thing your question is tripping me up with is this relitigated, because it was never litigated. This is the civil penalty system where these people send in their money.
But again, this happens all the time in civil penalty systems. I mean, you know, this city of Cincinnati has a ordinance about landlords having to have certain licenses. You can get fined by that. Now, maybe that's unconstitutional, but if you pay the fine, can you really come back years later and file a lawsuit saying it's unconstitutional and you shouldn't have collected that?
Well, again, it would have to be, you know, pretty unique circumstances like we have here. I mean, this is a situation where you just cannot look at this and say, oh, these people had their chance. They had this mechanism that would have worked. It would not have worked. We all know it wouldn't have worked. And what we know from Dixon and Campbell is that it's a long, hard fight for anybody who wants their $100 back. Remember, it wasn't just that they let this appeal go on. They were not playing nice, all right? And you're not going to have this in your scenario, I'm sure. They were billing and aggressively trying to collect from the Dixon firm during their appeal. And these are summary judgment exhibits. They send out a letter in March of 2008. Telling them that they had default judgments entered against them, they're going to pursue collection against them, so forth and so on. 3 weeks later, we get a credit rating warning telling them that it's been referred out to private collection, that they're going to have their credit rating ruined, that they're not going to be able to get financing. And notice, the amount keeps going up. The amount goes 140 to 160. So as this appeal is pending, they are tacking on more fines because of the delay. So, yeah, maybe in your example where everyone's playing nice and the right to appeal is being respected, maybe that's a scenario where it works. But that's not what the city of Cleveland was doing. It was collect from everybody we can as fast as we can.
Council, do you think the penalty is calculated to discourage challenges?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Do you have any evidence as to why it's $100 flat?
Well, it's $100 flat. There's certain offenses where it could be $200, but then they tack on $20 here, $20 here, the longer it takes.
Well, right, but I'm saying the initial, because their argument it is, hey, you paid the fine, that you waived your ability to appeal this, so the $100. Do you know the background on that?
Yeah, tough luck for you. Yeah, I mean, that's the whole way it was set up. They don't give anyone notices saying, now that you've lost, you can pursue a 2506 appeal. They don't do any of that. They have notices that say, you forfeited your right to appeal. The Dixon firm got that, and obviously they had not forfeited their right to appeal. They are systematically discouraging anybody from doing anything other than sending in a check. You know, that's everything is geared towards pay the money now. You know, they made a lot of money off of this, millions and millions of dollars before the taxpayers put a stop to it. And now these administrative proceedings are relics because the General Assembly has stepped in and vested only the municipal courts with jurisdiction over traffic citations. So the problem is fixed. But here, all we're saying is that, you know, they got to follow their own ordinance. And it's all about responsible government. I mean, if they exceed their authority, intentional or not, the right thing to do is to send everybody their money back. And it may be, Justice DeWine, in your situation with the building code and so forth, it's an honest mistake. That's not here. I mean, Maria Vargas said
well,
this.
It could be a law that's flatly unconstitutional.
Right. That would be somebody making a judgment call and saying this is how we look at it. Then they find out they got it wrong. Here they knew. They knew what they were doing.
So the exception is if you're really wrong, then you can relitigate it?
Degrees of wrongness? No. What I'm saying is that there's got to be a lot of factors to look at. And one factor here is that this was not an honest mistake. This was Maria Vargas saying in her deposition, pages 113 to 114, question, where in the ordinance does it allow you to issue citations to a non-owner driver? Answer, it does not. Question, so you guys were issuing notices to non-owners and you knew you weren't allowed to? Objection. Question, is that correct? Objection. Answer, yeah. Everybody knew what was going on. It's just a matter of making them follow their own ordinance, protecting the integrity of this system and the integrity of the government, and sending the money back.
What is the legal import of the business rules of the city of Cleveland in relation to the ordinance?
Sorry, trouble with the new order up there now. Well, the business rules, as the 8th District pointed out, that really does lock it down as far as futility for the administrative level. You know, this was set in stone there, and all those hearing officers had to follow those. So it was a foregone conclusion. And sure, that administrative appeal was free and easy and so forth, but the rest of it is not. 2506 is a different animal. I mean, that's something that takes a very sophisticated lawyer and a client that's got the finances to back it up, and it's just not an effective remedy here, which is the futility doctrine. And the futility doctrine is followed in every state. We just submitted supplemental authority showing that courts across the country are still applying it over the last year. It is widely recognized that if they're going to divest everybody of their right to the judicial system, they have to show, as the party asserting the affirmative defense, they have to show it's effective and expedient. And this is neither. I mean, that 2506 appeal took 2 years with their lawyers aggressively defending it. So it is not something that the ordinary consumer who's been hit with a $100 ticket is going to take a chance on, particularly when the ticket's going to go up to $160 and they have to endure collection efforts. It's just never been a practical option for these people. If I could just jump to race judicata, first and foremost, I've said this every time it's come up, no court has ever mentioned it, but race judicata is not in their answer. It was waived. They have failure to exhaust, they have collateral estoppel, those are different defenses than race judicata. It's not in there, it's waived. That's Jim's Steakhouse, which this court squarely held that even a municipality has to affirmatively allege their affirmative defenses. On remand, they didn't make it an issue. Judge McMonagle didn't get into it because of that. You just can't dupe a trial judge into ignoring an issue and then criticizing them for it on appeal. It had to be raised somewhere. And remember, initially it was only raised in a footnote to their original summary judgment briefing. I perfectly understand why they didn't put it in their answer. It doesn't apply. I mean, for res judicata, you have to have a valid prior judgment. As Justice Fisher was alluding to, that's not something that's just kind of whimsical. I mean, Civil Rule 58 spells out what you need for a judgment. It's got to be signed by a judge or judicial officer. It has to be journalized on the docket. It's formal. It sets deadlines running. It's something that we take very seriously. We don't just say, hey, you know, they could have done this. That's a judgment. And that's what that Sixth Circuit Carol McCarthy case said. It's an aberration. I've no doubt they were trying to get that case off their docket. There has never been any court anywhere in the United States that we have found that has said and agreed that, yeah, you can have a judgment by implication, and then through that implication you get res judicata. It just doesn't happen. Part of that is not only you have to have a final judgment, you have to have actual litigation for res judicata. And again, we don't have that here. The case they're citing, this Winslow case, you've got actual orders issued by an administrative agency there. Those were entitled to res judicata effect. We don't have this here. And remember, in their ordinance, you know, they've been talking a lot about this, about how it says, supposedly says, you have to appeal or you admit to the violation. That's not what it says. This is subsection K of the ordinance. And remember, it doesn't apply by definition to our class members because they are not owners. And the ordinance only applies to vehicle owners. So they're not subject to this to begin with. But it says in subsection K, the failure to give notice of appeal or pay the civil penalty within the time period shall constitute a waiver of the right to contest the ticket and shall be considered an admission. Almost all of our class members paid their civil fines. There's a few who didn't. Almost all of them paid. So under this, they didn't admit to anything. And it's the way they've written it. That's their ordinance. That's their language. Nobody admitted to anything, even if they are subject to this as owners, which they're not.
Didn't they admit to a waiver?
They didn't admit to anything.
According to that you just read, it was a waiver, right?
If you don't pay.
Right.
Notice of appeal or pay. You got two ways to avoid it, and everybody here would have avoided it by paying. Okay. Right? You know, it's again, it's this mentality of do everything you can to get them to send in a check.
But didn't it say or appeal?
Right.
Or appeal.
Right. You can do one or the other. Right. Why else would you have this language in there or pay the citation? Because what they're trying, the way they're reading it makes that superfluous, you know, which we can't do. So it's one or the other. And again, that's assuming this even applies to non-owners, which it does not. So with that, we would ask you to affirm the 8th District in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you. Council? Council, how is this done now for rental cars?
Well, Your Honor, I believe, as Mr. Flowers indicated, the citizens of Cleveland had a charter amendment that voted. There's no more camera enforcement.
Right, right. I should have known that.
Just make a couple quick points.
Just one more question.
Sure.
Can you explain to me what import a business rule has in the legal analysis? I mean, it's not like a rule to a statute. Is it just a practice for the hearing officer?
It's just I won't say informal, but it's not a promulgated rule. It's a rule that recognizes how they viewed the additional owner being a lessee. Just a couple
Thank
points.
Thank you.
A couple points, Your Honor. If you look at the Winslow versus Bartek case, it didn't say that the city had issued orders. It said that the city of Columbus had issued 10 allegations against the restaurant that was involved in that matter. Their failure to appeal or respond to those allegations resulted in the res judicata decision that the court entered, denying them the right to file their declaratory judgment action. I think Winslow versus Bartek goes to the issue of res judicata and whether there is a final order, the same way that Winslow versus Bartek does. They knew they had violated the speed limit. They admitted they violated the speed limit by paying. This argument about that he just read about failure to appeal or pay, it's failure to pay results in an admission. It's not that you pay and somehow you have the right to wait and see what happens down the road. It's like you file a notice of appeal, which they did not do, they just paid. But if you fail to pay, then you've admitted the liability also. There's at least one of the names.
But whether you pay or not, you've admitted liability in your argument.
Not if you ask for a notice or an appeal, Your Honor.
But let me go back for a little minute. Is it the position of the city of Cleveland that an administrative exhaustion, which is meant to prevent cases to go into court, that is set up by ordinance, but which through a business rule or informal practice is not going to allow somebody to have a chance to win, is not futile?
No, Your Honor, because futility does not rest with the administrative officer himself. If you look at the case the 8th District relied upon, San Allen versus Buer.
I understand the case law. I'm talking as a matter of de facto activity. What's actually going on? And a city creates an administrative appellate process, but then tells its administrative judges, this defense we will not accept, how is that a valid administrative process, which are, and the reason we give exhaustion remedies is to prevent court cases, when people wouldn't have a chance of winning?
Well, Your Honor, it's the reason you have 2506, to correct an administrative hearing agency if they're incorrect as a matter of law.
Counsel, how is it an effective remedy if you're guaranteed to lose?
You're not guaranteed to lose. Dixon and Campbell won, as did Mr. Barnes in a pro se appeal.
But prior to that, the policies within Cleveland were directed, based on the testimony, you were going to lose. You were going to lose.
Well, Your Honor, that wasn't broadcast that you're bound to lose. None of the people receiving a ticket would have known they're bound to lose. They didn't appeal because they preferred just to pay the $100 fine. And when they did that—
Let me ask you the question that I asked Mr. Flowers about the dollar amount. Is that $100 calculated to discourage challenges, was it?
No, Your Honor, and I can only say that when this court considered the writ of prohibition that was brought back in 2006 in Scott versus the City of Cleveland, that $100 fine was there just as it was at the time of this case, and this court found an adequate remedy at law because it was a 2506 appeal. They forewent their adequate remedy at law as relied upon by the city in this case, that was available. The 8th District made the same finding. You know, with regards to this thing about tacking on fines, if you read Ms. Vargas's deposition, and we reference it in our brief, that was a mistake that Dixon and Campbell got those letters. Ms. Vargas testified clearly that all proceedings were stayed during a period of appeal. A mistake is made, that happens, but he never paid those fines. He didn't pay anything. As far as the res judicata defense, the affirmative defense that former counsel in answering this complaint raised was plaintiffs are collaterally estopped from filing suit. Now, you leave out the word collateral, estopped from filing suit. That's res judicata because they've already had the opportunity and they paid, and there's a final judgment or order against them because of that. I think that the words of the affirmative defense go to res judicata. Another point to make on that is it wasn't until the supplemental briefing on the class cert appeal on this matter that these folks even raised the fact that they wanted to say that res judicata had not been pled. Certainly the 8th District, you vacated their decision on res judicata, but they applied. They looked at us, and they understood we had argued res judicata, and they took that into account.
Counsel, your time is up.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you.